Chair of the Advisory Committee of the Lorraine Beitler Dreyfus Collection. I want to begin our program by saying just a few words about the Advisory Committee and its purpose. The principal goal of the committee, which includes scholars, library personnel, students, and community leaders, is to help to guide the use of the materials in the collection so that its resources are made known and available to the academic, national, and international communities. This is accomplished by giving access here at Van Pelt to those interested in the Dreyfus Affair and by arranging to lend materials from the collection to various academic and civic organizations for exhibition. To date, such exhibitions have taken place on six continents at universities, civic institutions, and military academies, and the most recent, I'm proud to say, was an exhibition in my native Australia. The committee believes that the fundamental human issues of the Dreyfus Affair are global and contemporary to be drawn from the injustices and crimes which were perpetrated during the course of the affair. In doing so, we want to use the collection to highlight the ways in which democratic processes, the legal system, and the power of the press were all used to arrive at redressing the wrongs that were perpetrated and eventually to proving the innocence of Alfred Dreyfus, the victim of prejudice, racism, and nationalism. We believe that it is also important that these lessons be applied not only to the evils of anti-Semitism, but indeed to all varieties of racism and prejudice, wherever and whenever they might occur. Now it's my very great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Carton Rogers, who is Vice Provost and Director of Libraries at the University of Pennsylvania. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank him for his interest in and his work on behalf of the Dreyfus Collection and for offering us the hospitality of the Van Pelt Library for this important event. Carton.
Thank you, Lance, very much. Welcome, everybody. It's very heartening. Certainly from the library's point of view, but also from the point of view of the Dreyfus Committee to see so many interested people turned out tonight. So we're really excited to have a full house. It is a full house. I apologize for that. There's not a lot of room. I hope you can hear me and hear the speakers as the evening goes by. You're sitting in the rare book and manuscript part of the Van Pelt Dietrich Library Center. We have very ambitious plans to turn this space into an extraordinary set of spaces that will meet the needs of 21st century scholars. Unfortunately, this library was built in 1962. We've had to refurbish the spaces space by space, and you just happen to be sitting in the last space that hasn't been renovated. So hopefully, maybe by the 2010 or 2012 event that we have surrounding this extraordinary collection, we'll all be sitting in newly renovated spaces. I'd like to take just a couple of minutes to talk a little bit more about the collection and about the extraordinary woman who has built the collection, sustains its vitality, and more importantly, its mission. The Lorraine Beitler Collection of the Dreyfus Affair contains over 1,000 items documenting the history of the Dreyfus Affair, from the wrongful conviction of Captain Alfred Dreyfus for treason in 1894 through Emile Zola's involvement and ultimately to Dreyfus's exoneration in 1906. This extraordinary collection includes posters, broadsides, newspapers, magazines, correspondence, photographs, postcards, books, now stamps, I'll get to that in a minute, and material culture related to the affair. As extraordinary as the collection is, and as important it is to the special collections at the University of Pennsylvania, perhaps more so is the person who put this collection together, Lorraine Beitler. I thought it would be interesting and useful to read something that was written about Lorraine in 1998 by Henri Mitterrand, because I think it really explains very clearly who she is and what this collection means. Dr. Lorraine Beitler, an American collector impassioned by the history of the Dreyfus Affair, has brought together an exceptional group of original documents on the actors and episodes of the major political and judicial affair which shook the French Republic at the end of the last century. She has presented them in an exhibition which evokes for visitors the martyrdom of Captain Alfred Dreyfus, the error of his accusers, the lucidity and courage of his defenders, and the ultimate success of truth and of justice after years of lies, breaches of duty, and baseness. The collection informs and educates with its own particular power. Lorraine Beitler is one of those numerous Americans who have tried to preserve and extend the rights and liberties of their country. She has turned a French affair into an example in order to demonstrate to her compatriots the virtue of civic action. At the same time, she encourages us never to forget the lessons of the Dreyfus affair. I think that may give you a sense of why I am so pleased that the director, as the director of libraries at the University of Pennsylvania, to have Penn associated with this collection and with the extraordinary person who put it together. Penn's special collections are what defines us as a library, and they are gaining in importance as time goes by. I'd like to end by quoting, doing another quote, and this time from a former superintendent of West Point, a Lieutenant General Daniel W. Chrisman, who was reacting to a 1999 exhibition from the Beitler Collection at West Point. And I quote him, "We are thrilled to be a partner in the display of Dr. Lorraine Beitler's critically important exhibition about the trial, conviction, and exoneration of French Army Captain Alfred Dreyfus. A tragic example of how prejudice can run amok under the cloak of national security concerns. We must study cases like those of Dreyfus to ensure that discipline and security are never used as excuses to justify racial or religious prejudices. I think it's safe to say in our post 9/11 world, we need to be exposed to the Dreyfus affair and to the message inherent in the Beitler collection more now than ever." So again, thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. And I'd like to accept for the Penn Libraries this extraordinary gift of first edition stamps and envelopes printed in 2006 by the French government to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the exoneration of Alfred Dreyfus. So on behalf of the library, I'd like to thank Lorraine and Yael Ruiz for this particular gift. Thank you very much. It'll be a very nice addition to the Beitler collection. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Yael Pearl Ruiz. Yael is the great-granddaughter, as you can see on your program, of Alfred Dreyfus, and it's an extraordinary pleasure to welcome her to Philadelphia and have her with us tonight. She was born in Paris, as you probably might guess. and she, let's see here, she is the granddaughter of Jean, right? Jean, okay. And her mother is Simone, and you're one of six children. And, six children. She was trained as a French teacher and is taught in Mexico and in Israel. She's fluent in French, Spanish, English, and Hebrew. She's a volunteer in the Israeli Army. She's created her own import, export, and advertising company. And now she's a fashion designer in Paris. An extraordinary set of skills. So it's very nice to have you here. Please welcome Yael Ruiz.
Okay. Well, my English is not so good, but I'll try. So, in 1994, Lorraine Beitler met with my mother and I in Paris for the first time. Her goal was to ask. You don't hear me here? Okay. Thank you. Okay. Her goal was to assemble historical materials to create a traveling exhibition whose aim was to bring light to the history of the Dreyfus affair and to the universal values of truth, justice, and human rights. Her exhibition have since that time traveled around the world from South Africa to the Senate of France, always enriched with new terms and documents. I would like to offer thanks and profound compliments to Lorraine Beitler for her extraordinary work in making the truth of the affair better known to the world. My great-grandfather, Alfred Dreyfus, the victim of a judicial crime, knew how to withstand without hatred or scorn the tortures inflicted upon him. He proved to be a man of exceptional character and not only rehabilitated the honor of his family name, but rendered honor to France, which ultimately recognized the wrong that had been committed and rehabilitated him on July 12, 1906. It was in this spirit that France rendered homage to him in the year 2006, the centenary of the recognition of Captain Dreyfus' innocence. To commemorate this centenary, many events took place under the auspices of the highest authorities of the state, of justice, and of culture. In particular, the following were especially noteworthy. President of the Republic, Jacques Chirac, organized a national ceremony in the courtyard of honor of the École Militaire on July 12, 2006, in homage of, and I quote, an exemplary officer and a patriot who passionately loved France. The Supreme Court of Appeal, in the same audience chamber in which the judgment of July 12, 1906, rehabilitating Dreyfus was pronounced, organized a conference presided over by Mr. Guy Canivet, first president of the Court of Appeal. At the Museum of Art and History of Judaism in Paris, a magnificent exhibition was presented. The exhibition cleared away the prejudices surrounding the person of Alfred Dreyfus, wrongly accused of being a passive and unsympathetic victim. A commemorative postage stamp was published in his honor. The stamp, which you have seen here this evening, shows Alfred Dreyfus being decorated with the Legion of Honor in 1906. I was very pleased that they had decided upon this image and not that of the degradation so often seen. The high point of this commemoration was the recognition of the personal struggle in which Alfred Dreyfus was engaged until the declaration of his innocence in July 1906 and the vindication of his image, which had been so deformed in the preceding years. I would like in this regard to render homage to my mother, Madame Simone Perle, who passed away 2 years ago. The eldest of the grandchildren of Alfred and Lucy, she knew her grandfather very well and was 18 when he died in 1935. She devoted her life to correct the erroneous image that had formed around her grandfather. One of the early acts of the Vichy government during the war was to size the founds of Lucy, then in her 70s. With the aid of her grandchildren, Madeleine and Simone, was Lucy able to survive the horror of the occupation in a convent in South France? Tragically, Madeleine would die in Auschwitz 50 years after her grandfather's degradation. The Dreyfus affair remains relevant and rich with contemporary lessons. It is an excellent example of the horror of which men are capable of inflicting on innocents simply because they are Jewish. But the affair also shows the value of the exemplary courage of Émile Zola, who never hesitated to take great risks to defend an innocent against the crushing injustice of so many others. The current position of democracy in the world is unstable. The values of tolerance and justice and the principle of democracy are threatened and under attack. If by the 22nd century we want humanity to celebrate the bicentenary of Captain Dreyfus' rehabilitation with the same values of tolerance, justice and human rights, we must remain vigilant. It is to those values that the collection and exhibition on the Dreyfus affair at the University of Pennsylvania contribute, and which thus continues the educational mission begun more than a decade ago by Lorraine Beitler. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those very moving words. And now I'd like to introduce the curator of the collection, Dr. Lorraine Beitler, as also the director of the Beitler Foundation, and she in turn is going to introduce our speaker for the evening. Lorraine.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Thank you. For this, our inaugural, can you hear me? Okay, let's start. How's this? Good? For this, our inaugural distinguished lecture series, I've been given the brief of the introduction of briefly introducing Professor Paula Hyman, and that's a challenge. As many of you know, Paula Hyman has had and continues to have a brilliant and eventful career as a writer, a scholar, a teacher, an agent of positive change in the Jewish community. I have known Paula for probably more years than either of us care to remember. So, at an early exhibition on the Dreyfus Affair at a conference at Cape Town University in South Africa is the first time we met. Paula Hyman is currently the Lucy Moses Professor of Modern Jewish History at Yale University, where she offers courses on topics of modern European and American Jewish history, with a special emphasis on the history of women and gender. She has received many awards and holds several honorary degrees at the American Library Association's Dartmouth Medal Award, New York Public Library, the 204 Cultural Foundation for Cultural Jewish Culture. Her co-edited Jewish Women, a comprehensive encyclopedia, has recently appeared in a CD-ROM format. She is currently preparing a brief biography of Leon Blum for a series of Jews on modern history. In addition to her exemplary teaching and scholarship, Paul Hyman has modeled an exemplary civic role in working for change both within and beyond the academy. As well as being the first woman to hold a chair in Jewish studies at a major American university, Professor Paula Hyman was also a founding member of Ezrat Nashim, a Jewish feminist organization that helped change the role of women in conservative Judaism, leading to the ordination of women as rabbis. It is entirely appropriate, therefore, that Professor Hyman should be our first distinguished lecturer. Her presence this evening confirms an ongoing belief to the foundation of the Dreyfus Collection at Penn. Although the events of the Dreyfus Affair took place 100 years ago, the historical issues continue to remain contemporary imperatives. The Dreyfus Affair, for over a century, has offered and continues to offer lessons in civic courage, ethnic tolerance, and international mobilization, as well as human rights. Paula Hyman speaks to this issue. Help me welcome her.
It's really an honor for me to be here. I remember seeing the wonderful collection that Dr. Beitler, Lorraine, had collected in Cape Town, and the material resonated there in a way that it perhaps cannot resonate in America, because it raised so many issues. This was right after apartheid had ended, and it raised all kinds of issues about what kind of society South Africa was going to be, and whether the values that ultimately triumphed in the Dreyfus Affair would govern the new South Africa. And I'm actually pleased at what has happened in the years since. I'm speaking on a very broad topic, The Dreyfus Affair and Contemporary Anti-Semitism. And I have to apologize in advance because there will be, first of all, some of the material will go very quickly, and also there will be gross generalizations that you may be anxious to pick apart. I hope you won't, and that you'll listen to this with some forgiveness of the breadth of the topic. The Dreyfus Affair was not about anti-Semitism, but it was the most visible example of anti-Semitism in fin de siècle Western and Central Europe. Anti-Semitism was endemic and taken for granted throughout Europe. In France, Edouard Drumont's La France Juive, a two-volume virulent attack on Jews, published in 1886, was wildly popular, selling 100,000 copies in its first year. Germany, too, had many anti-Semitic bestsellers. However, the only expressions of anti-Semitism that received widespread international media attention before the Dreyfus Affair were the 1881 pogroms in Russia. Physical attacks were barbaric, a sign of Russian backwardness. Everyday anti-Jewish social prejudice among the bourgeoisie and the upper classes was, most Europeans thought, understandable. So was hatred of Jews among the lower classes, because the Jews were considered responsible for the sins of capitalism. I know that some of you have seen the video, but for those of you who haven't and might have forgotten the outline of the affair, let me briefly remind you of the key events, and then we will talk about the issues that I want to raise. When written evidence of army-based espionage for Germany is found in the fall of 1894, purportedly on the basis of his handwriting, Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish army officer originally from Alsace, is arrested shortly thereafter. He is speedily convicted in a closed court-martial and sentenced to perpetual exile and solitary confinement on Devil's Island. Incriminating evidence against the real traitor, Esterhazy, surfaces in 1896, and one army officer, convinced of Dreyfus's innocence, Lieutenant Colonel Picard, begins compiling a dossier on the irregularities of the case. To solidify their case against Dreyfus, some army officers forge documents, and Picard is reassigned. Although the Dreyfusards, the supporters of Dreyfus, publish material to prove Dreyfus's innocence, the matter simmers until Esterhazy, whose name has resurfaced regarding the espionage, demands a court-martial to prove his innocence. And I guess he was pretty sure that the court-martial would turn out the right way. And guess what? It did. He was acquitted in January 1898. Emile Zola writes his public letter, J'accuse, that condemns the army and the government for their injustice and corruption, and the case becomes the affair. It took over 3 years for that to happen. It's sometimes very easy to say, well, Dreyfus was exonerated in 1896. For Alfred Dreyfus and his family, that was a long time. Passionate arguments fill the newspapers. The intellectual and political world is split by the affair. Riots erupt, duels occur, and the case unravels, but at a painstakingly slow pace. The army's central forger, Major Henri, commits suicide. Esterhazy is discredited because of different forms of, malfeasance, and he flees. And in 1899, a decision is made to hold another court-martial of Dreyfus. It takes place in August and September 1899, and Dreyfus is again found guilty, although this time, and this is a wonderful phrase, with extenuating circumstances. Concerned about the upcoming World's Fair, which is to be held in Paris in 1900, the government offers, and they were very worried about how this was going to play in the media, the conviction of Dreyfus again, the government offers and Dreyfus accepts a pardon. The Dreyfusar triumph in elections. Catholic religious orders are dissolved. They had been very involved opposing Dreyfus and supporting the army. And in 1905, the separation of church and state is declared. When all the documents relating to his case are made available in 1903, Dreyfus petitions for a retrial. Not until 1906 does the Court of Appeals annul the second court-martial conviction, restore Dreyfus to his former rank, and award him a place in the Legion of Honor. That's the bare-bones outline of the affair. Anti-Semitism fueled the affair in many ways. It guided the French army elite to select Alfred Dreyfus, the only Jew on the general staff, to be arrested for treason in the fall of 1894. His selection was not surprising. After all, Jews were upstarts and bore the stigma of traitors culturally as descendants of Judas, who had sold Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Anti-Semitism played into the popular anger of those who felt victimized by economic conditions. It enabled those who framed Dreyfus to justify their deceptions by pointing to the nefariousness of the Jewish conspiracy, the economic and political conspiracy against France. Anti-Semitism was visible before the Dreyfus case became the affair. It enabled Drumont, right after Dreyfus was arrested, to use his newspaper to campaign vigorously for Dreyfus's conviction with the assertion that Jews who wielded influence on the government were pushing to cover up the crime. Popular anti-Semitism erupted as early as January 5, 1895, when Dreyfus underwent a humiliating public ceremony of degradation, accompanied by 20,000 onlookers who shouted, "Death to the traitor and death to the Jews." And finally, anti-Semitism mobilized urban masses in provincial cities and in Algeria to riot against the Jews in response to Emile Zola's letter, perhaps cri de coeur is a better way of describing it, which he had published after the real traitor Esterhazy was acquitted in a court-martial. As both Stephen Wilson and Pierre Birnbaum have shown in the past two decades, the riots were more widespread than previously acknowledged. In metropolitan France, they included many provincial cities as well as Paris. In the metropole, most of the violence involved loss of property and a few injuries. In Algeria, which was then French, where the riots were more extensive and brutal, assaults on Jews were more common. 158 Jewish shops were looted or burned to the ground, and two Jews were killed. For many years, historians discounted the significance of the anti-Semitism in the affair. But the last two decades have witnessed a refocusing of the historical lens. This collection of Dreyfusiana, can I call it that? has been donated to the University of Pennsylvania so generously by Lorraine Beitler, and her husband Marty, and also has been augmented by the gift of Yael Ruiz. This collection demonstrates the weaving of anti-Semitism into the very fabric of the affair. I am not so much interested in the details of the anti-Semitism as the way in which anti-Semitism functioned then and how it functions in the contemporary environment in France, about which you probably know more than I do, Yael, because I'm not living it. Anti-Semitism, stirred up by agitators and demagogues with their own press at their disposal, fueled the affair. But it was not the subject of the affair, and that was made very clear in introducing this collection. The affair was about justice. An innocent man, after all, had been convicted of high treason, and he suffered a horrible prison exile. It was also about politics, who should rule. But more fundamentally, the affair was about what vision of France would prevail, a Republican France built on the ideals of the 1789 revolution, which granted equality to individuals, regardless of religious affiliation or ethnic origin, or a France which celebrated its medieval heritage, shared Catholicism, and hierarchical social structures. The promoters of that second vision of France were not only anti-Semitic themselves, because that was part of their vision. The Jews didn't quite belong, in fact, didn't belong at all, in their vision of France. They saw anti-Semitism also as a useful tool to mobilize support for their political message. And Alfred Dreyfus was a convenient symbol of a tolerant France that offered citizenship to people who did not share France's medieval Catholic heritage, and that opened its doors, the university, the civil service, and yes, the army officer corps to them. As Pierre Birnbaum has documented in his Les Fous de la République, unimaginatively translated as Jews of the Republic. I would call it Crazy About the Republic, because that's what the book is about. As he documented, during the Third Republic, Jews were able to make their careers in the major institutions of the state, and they experienced few obstacles to their advancement. There could have been no Dreyfus Affair in Germany in the 1890s, even though anti-Semitism in Germany was as strong as in France, because Germany simply excluded Jews from serving as officers in its army. There was no equivalent to Captain... There was no equivalent to Captain Dreyfus in Germany. So political anti-Semitism of late 19th century Europe was rooted in traditional Christian anti-Jewish imagery and in the anxiety of those whose economic position was eroding because of the development of industrial capitalism. It was supported by an alliance of conservative economic elites with the masses of the lower middle class who had recently been enfranchised. Contemporary anti-Semitism in Europe is far different from the anti-Semitism of the time of the Dreyfus Affair, and it's important to recognize those differences. The social and political context of our own times have drastically altered. Contemporary anti-Semitism reflects a confluence of strange bedfellows. First, disaffected immigrant and second-generation immigrant youth who have suffered from poverty in the working-class suburbs of French cities and have not been structurally integrated into the larger society. Especially the Muslims among them have been taught that Jews are the children of Satan. Many second-generation immigrants hold Jews ultimately responsible for the disadvantaged situation in France, and they accept anti-Semitic stereotypes about Jewish wealth and power. That's the first group. Second are the remnants and heirs of 20th century European racism and extreme nationalism on the right. And third, those elements on the left, not the entire left, but those elements on the left who see Jews, because they support Israel, as the new Nazis. It is an alliance of strange bedfellows, but a potent alliance nonetheless. Even though the circumstances have changed, understanding the Dreyfus Affair of a century ago is useful for those who confront anti-Semitism and racism in contemporary Europe. Anti-Semitism was then and is now a cultural code. It's not just opposition to and hatred of Jews. It's an opposition to and hatred of Jews as symbols of something larger. That is why anti-Semitism can thrive even in the absence of Jews. There were hardly any Jews left in Poland in the 1970s because most of them had been murdered during the Holocaust and had been pushed out in 1968. But Poland managed to have anti-Semitism without Jews anyway. At the time of the Dreyfus Affair, Jews were symbols of the changes of the modern world. They were the creators and the beneficiaries of capitalism, that evil economic system that was sucking the blood from both the simple peasant and the factory worker. They were the symbol of the modern city, a place where decadence ran rampant, where sexual diseases thrived, and where the plain rural virtues that had characterized society in the past were uprooted. They were the symbol of an egalitarian society, where people did not know their proper place, and where everyone consequently suffered chaos. And they were the symbol of a modernist culture that embraced change, that valued the new, and that scorned tradition. Today, the Jews are once again the symbol of the political evils of modern Western society. But the symbolism has changed. They are identified with or perceived as actually controlling the United States, the only international superpower, which is seen as having brought war and destruction to innocent third world countries, and seen always as always seeking domination. They are the symbol of the Western erosion of traditional values. The religious backdrop of contemporary anti-Semitism has also changed. Traditional Christian anti-Judaism is no longer a major force in popular anti-Semitism. It is a minor force because some tropes of traditional Christian anti-Judaism have an indirect influence through their entry into Islamic discourse as a result of the presence of Christians and the growing influence of European consuls in Arab countries in the 19th century. And I have to add that the impact of the classic anti-Semitic text, The Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion, has been extraordinarily strong in the contemporary Middle East. And that is a text that draws on Christian tropes. But these tropes, as I said, are not at the forefront. The prominence of Israel in contemporary anti-Semitic discourse in Europe is a reflection less of Israeli policy, although some on the political left may assert differently than I just said. It's less a reflection of Israeli policy than a manifestation of Muslim inability to accept Jewish sovereignty over any Muslim land. That is, Israel is not only to be hated because of the colonialism of post-1967 occupation. Israel is ipso facto illegitimate from its foundation. European leftists, that's the third element, for their part, simply find it easier to identify with the underdog or the victim. Jews today are too prosperous and powerful to wave the banner of victimhood. With all the changes in social and political context, both the anti-Semitism at the time of the Dreyfus Affair and contemporary European anti-Semitism share a belief in the Jews as masterminds of widely divergent social and economic movements. The protocols, which I mentioned, merely strengthen and make explicit today the conspiracy theory that animates all modern political anti-Semitism. Just as 19th century anti-Semitism united peasants and landowners, artisans, some workers and shopkeepers, against a supposedly powerful group stigmatized as other and depicted as responsible for France's economic and political woes, so contemporary anti-Semitism unites persons of the political left and the political right, along with disaffected and alienated children of immigrants, against that same supposedly powerful group of stigmatized others, depicted as responsible for a different set of political and social ills. The most pertinent message of the Dreyfus Affair, I think, for today is the importance of political elites in leading the campaign against intolerance and the stigmatization of minorities that allow hatred to fester and violence to occur. The mobilization of intellectuals and politicians in support of the victim of a miscarriage of justice and ultimately in favor of a judicial system and a polity that support the rights of all individuals and herald the equality of all citizens, that argument was central to the vindication of Dreyfus and the erosion of anti-Semitism. Early Dreyfusards included not only the dedicated members of Dreyfus's own family, and that should be mentioned, but also prominent non-Jews, such as the politicians Charles Schirrer Kessner, a Protestant, I think it's not irrelevant. The Protestants were none too happy with the Catholic domination of France. So there's a Charles Schirrer Kessner and Georges Clemenceau, who was also the political editor of the newspaper L'Aurore, and it was in L'Aurore that Zola published his J'accuse. Lucien Ayre, the respected librarian of the École Normale, was also involved. The novelist Émile Zola was obviously the key player in spurring support for Dreyfus, but Jean Jaurès, the leader of the Socialist Party, also played a major role in alerting the left to the potential negative consequences of the Dreyfus Affair and its anti-Semitism, negative consequences for the working classes. Like most socialists, Jaurès was for quite a while indifferent to the fate of a bourgeois army captain. But he recognized in the wake of Zola's manifesto that the defeat of the bourgeois republic in the Dreyfus Affair boded ill for the future triumph of a socialist republic. In general, the engagement of intellectuals and politicians as Dreyfusards contributed to the ultimate vindication of Dreyfus and the weakening of anti-Semitism in France. Indicative of the staying power of anti-Semitism, however, and I'm speaking not only about France, but throughout the world, anti-Semitism and its conspiracy theory is the fact that there still exist in France believers in Dreyfus's guilt. That Dreyfus's guilt was whitewashed becomes proof for anti-Semites of the pernicious ability of the Jewish cabal. In their view, that cabal controls the media, the historical profession, and all French governments, presumably except that of Vichy, and thereby monopolizes the narrative of the past. The sad conclusion that I draw from this is that the true believer in a conspiracy, not only anti-Semitism, but anti-Semitism is a very prominent conspiracy, the true believer cannot be convinced by any contrary evidence, since all evidence provided by the enemy is automatically discounted. So I'm going to give you a couple of minutes on the contemporary situation. The response of politicians and intellectuals to the eruption of anti-Semitism in France in the new century has been ambiguous. By now, there is little denial that anti-Semitic incidents have proliferated in France. Jewish students report feeling unsafe in public schools, and many parents have transferred their children to Jewish private schools. Incidents of arson and other destruction of Jewish property, along with occasional physical attacks on Jews, have become increasingly common. According to a very recent 2007 report by CRIF, which is the umbrella organization of French Jewry, physical attacks on Jews in France increased by 48% last year, and verbal attacks by 71%. In a three-week period, just a three-week period, in early 2006, for example, eight men in Sarcelles, a Parisian suburb, beat the son of the rabbi and another Jew the next day. And a 23-year-old young Jew in the most shocking incident that has been has received considerable publicity. A 23-year-old young Jew, Ilan Halimi, the son of Moroccan immigrant parents, was kidnapped and murdered in the suburb of Bagneux. By the way, there was some dispute as to whether this should be seen as a hate crime. Maybe they just wanted money from him. It was... How relevant was it? I don't buy this, but how relevant was it that he was Jewish, et cetera, et cetera. In any case, the Boston Globe described the group that kidnapped him and murdered him as a predominantly Muslim youth gang dedicated to crime, street fighting, rap music, and virulent anti-Semitism. The shared characteristics of the gang members was not their Muslim background, but their immigrant origins. It was a multicultural gang with Arabs, blacks from Africa and the Caribbean, a French-Iranian, and a Portuguese, all of whom shared anti-Semitic stereotypes. A West African resident of the housing project where Halimi was murdered commented in an interview with a reporter, "It's too bad," and I'm quoting here, "it's too bad this happened because we immigrants are always blamed. But Jews have all the money and power. Everyone knows this and resents them. That's why they have these problems." A retired police chief and activist against anti-Semitism summed it up this way, "It's all mixed up. Gang stuff, violence, and a glaze of ideology. They hate Jews, they hate the West, they hate France. The Jews are the face they put on their generalized anger at the world. Anti-Semitism is, once again, a cultural code for the hegemony, let's say, or the oppression of the West over the rest of the world." The second generation immigrant youth culture is far more violent than the anti-Semitism at the time of the Dreyfus Affair. And yet the response of intellectuals and politicians, despite the memory of Vichy, has not been perceived as vigorous. President Chirac, I'm glad he issued the stamps, but President Chirac first denied that anti-Semitism had ever been part of French culture. In November of 2003, he then issued a statement on behalf of the nation condemning all acts of anti-Semitism, acts that are not in accord with the natural demands of the Republic. I don't know what that means. It was translated by the French Information Agency and put out in that form. But the rest, I think, is very understandable. Indeed, acts of anti-Semitism are attacks on the fundamental rights of each citizen, the right to have one's belief respected. When a Jew is attacked in France, it is an attack against the whole of France. At the same time, the French Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, who was running for president in the elections that will be held this coming weekend, declared, confronted with anti-Semitism and racism, I know only two words, zero tolerance. These are both strong statements, but critics have complained that the government has not implemented a changed policy. They really haven't put, their money where their mouth is. School teachers in particular await a new curriculum and a crackdown on expressions of hate. An inspector general of education in France, who wrote a report in 2004 that called anti-Semitism ubiquitous in the 61 schools he surveyed, said of the Minister of Education, and there are lots of quotes that he made of things that he saw, which I am not sharing with you here. He wrote of the Minister of Education, he has done nothing. He prefers not to talk about it. And this inspector noted, and I'm quoting, a stupefying and cruel reality in France. Jewish children, and they are alone in this case, can no longer be educated in just any school, by which I think he means in the public school system. Moreover, the situation of Jews has taken a back seat to the very real social problems of the children of North African, Arab, and African immigrants, most of whom are Muslim. There need be no competition for attention between Jewish victims of violence, both verbal and physical, and the hopeless youth of the suburbs. This is not a zero-sum game. One would assume that the French government would address both social problems. But the reality of the difference in numbers has had the consequence of diminishing the significance of anti-Semitic incidents, except to the Jews themselves. Intellectuals are more concerned with the seemingly insoluble social problems of integrating immigrants and their children, which seems to have more significant repercussions for the nature of French society and polity than the current manifestations of anti-Semitism. And politicians worry about the potential vote of 6 million naturalized immigrants. Yet Jews have been bellwethers of social values for more than two centuries in France. They are the canary in the mine shaft. Should their sense of vulnerability increase and their possibilities for full participation in French society be constricted, then the Republican values of contemporary France will suffer a grievous blow. And that is one of the messages of the Dreyfus Affair.
I'd like to thank Professor Hyman for this wonderful synthesis and very deep analysis of the problem of anti-Semitism in France, which contains lessons for us all here today. And she has graciously accepted to answer a number of questions, not too many, but because we do have other activities that are going to happen. So, yeah.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you how you feel about the evidences of anti-Semitism that are in the cultural elites of academia in France and in England. Recently, the English Society of University Professors has decided to boycott all Israeli educational institutions of higher education, and I really don't know the level of this type of thinking that's going on in France, but I'd like very much to know your thoughts about it.
It's a little far from what I was talking about today. I think that the evidence of anti-Semitism in academia, and it's not evident all over academia, there are pockets of it in academia. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing where others have to step up to the bar and deal with it and not simply turn their back against it. I followed the British case. I followed it for 2 years, and I thought that it had been finally voted down. I was involved, since I'm the president of the American Academy of Jewish Research, I was involved in writing something for the our profession in the United States. The Chronicle of Higher Education was involved with this, as the American Association of University Professors, and there are people in England who did not support that as well. So you're right that it is of some concern, and particularly because of the because it was very thoughtless, which was what I mean by that is that there was not much thought that went into the decision to boycott all Israeli academics, that this kind of boycott, which really makes no distinctions at all. And it is a question, should academics take political positions? Yes, I think they should. There are times when they should. Should they take positions in this way? I think they shouldn't. Yes.
Could you comment on the intellectual divide that was happening in the Dreyfus Affair with Degas and so forth?
Yeah, it is complicated. Degas was an anti-Semite. This wonderful book from the catalog of the exhibit at the Jewish Museum 20 years ago, and I think your mother may have come there. discusses the way in which the intellectual elite in France was split, and I think that it was split along divisions of what kind of France they wanted to see. I don't know enough about Degas. There is an article in that catalog on Degas specifically, and there were people who had been friends who were split irrevocably because of this affair, and I think the passions went very deep on both sides. Without a lot more research, I can't indicate why Degas went one way and other artists went the other way. Yeah.
Thanks for
you're supposed to be doing this.
a question on contemporary anti-Semitism. How do you think we explain that on the one hand, in recent years, the number of attacks in France have gone up, and also in public surveys, attitudes against Israel have become more and more critical, but at the same time, that according to the Anti-Defamation League, anti-Semitism surveys of 2002 and 2004 in France, anti-Semitism has actually fallen by 10%. How do you make sense of that?
I'm not a sociologist. I should have my friend Stephen Cohen here. He does polls of that sort. I'm aware of those polls, and it may be simply a manifestation of the fact that a small minority of people who get together can wreak a lot of havoc. That I doubt very much that people were very sympathetic to the riots in the banlieue, and I think that no one, I can't imagine that anyone was sympathetic to the kidnapping and murder of a 23-year-old who was actually also a second-generation immigrant youth. But the fact is that I mean, one of the questions is how do you really respond to lack of opportunity, to violence? How do you respond to lack of opportunity while making it clear that violence is, as Sarkozy said, you know, zero tolerance? But in fact, it hasn't really been zero tolerance on either. In either regard, for the immigrants and for the violence.
Yeah. Bob Wiener, Lafayette College. A little bit more complicated question, maybe. I'm just finishing La Désaccord, the Désaccord between Brauman and Finkelkraut. I had felt a long time ago, even during the continuous news of Holocaust issues in France in the late 90s and even after 2000, how much the continuous repetition of all of that would cause a deep psychological reaction in France, even though the whole process was appropriate, needed, positive, but with potential great dangers. I have tremendous difficulty understanding, other than using some of that, why the elites, especially many of the intellectual elites on the left, can't have more than one victim at a time, can't parse their criticism in the same way as they do in their own scholarship. And this is clearly a factor in France. It's also a factor in England at this point. Finkelkraut and Brauman agree on this and agree that there should be less public stuff and that the gathering for Halimi was in the end negative because it just causes more hatred for Jews. So one is damned if one does, one is damned if one doesn't. Il faut se taire, right? Okay. How do you react to the sense of the psychological considerations involved here? Any sense of that at all from the friends you speak with and from what you read?
I agree with you that it should be possible to deal with multiple victims. In terms of psychology, I have a gut feeling, but my gut feeling is as an American Jew. My gut feeling is that to say that airing the violence against Jews works against Jews, I think that's totally wrong. In the end, first of all, it sounds as though Jews are embarrassed that they have been attacked. It's somehow their fault. And second of all, I think that anyone who is going to be turned into an anti-Semite by a memorial, and in the same way should we just not mention the killings that took place just 2 days ago in Virginia? because somebody might respond the wrong way to them. I don't think that's the right approach. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm just responding as a person.
But would you have expected more from print scholars in terms of sensitivity issues?
I'd rather not.
Peter Kahn, I'll show you a bit of prejudice here, one of my colleagues.
Uh-huh.
Could you stand up, Peter, please?
If I heard the dates correctly, Dreyfus lived another 30 years. I take it must have died at about the time Leon Blum was becoming premier, with a kind of mid-30s. What, briefly, if you can do it briefly, was the rest, what were those 30 years like for Dreyfus?
I really don't know. His son Pierre. What was the next? You could probably talk about this more than I can. What were the next 30 years like? Dreyfus lived until 1935. He did not simply resume a military career and excel in the army. Simply because I would think that he experienced post-traumatic, what we would call in our time, post-traumatic stress syndrome. No?
What happened to Dreyfus is that he resigned of the army because he was not well reintegrated in the army.
Yeah, no. Yes.
Never gave him
no, that's what I'm not saying that it was his fault, but I think that some of the, it was interesting that Picard was elevated from lieutenant colonel, I think, to brigadier general. And Dreyfus was restored at the level that he had occupied in 1895.
No,
he was promoted afterwards.
Didn't take in consideration the 5 years that he
had. Yes, but his promotion was slow, and he did not, I don't think that his career developed as it might have. But I should tell you that as someone who read about the Dreyfus Affair primarily as a graduate student, when I read those books, this is what you read. Dreyfus was really an unlikable person. And that's why suspicion fell on him. Even as a graduate student, I thought, there's something wrong with that. Maybe that doesn't explain all of it. And these were reputable historians who wrote this. This was the kind of message. And I would think that the tensions between the right and the left in France were extremely strong in the interwar period. In terms of Blum, Blum, I think, very unfairly criticized the attitude of Jews to the Dreyfus Affair. He kind of fell back as the leader of the Socialist Party into saying that the only the socialists really had the right approach, and that bourgeois Jews were cowardly and craven, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think he would have written that in the last years of his life, by the way. But he did write that in 1937. And I don't know. I don't. Souvenir sur l'affaire, that's what I'm referring to. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You will have the opportunity to ask. You know that Paula Hyman and Yael Reese are not going away, so you can talk to them at the reception. And this is our next event, but let's thank our two speakers. And I also want to thank, to add my words of thanks to Cardinal Rogers, thanks to the curator of the collection, Lorraine Beitler. And there are two people who also need to be thanked, and these are two members of the library personnel who have worked wonders to get this event together. And I'm talking about Lynn Farrington and John Pollock, and I'd like you to thank them. And Finally, I'd like to remind you that, first of all, there is a book, a visitor's book there, which we'd like you to sign and add some comments to. There is the DVD, the 17-minute DVD, made by Lorraine on the Dreyfus Affair, will be shown in the Lee Library. And last but not least, we have a reception here so that after having had your mind nourished, you can now come and nourish your body. So please join us for the reception. And thank you all for coming. Thank you.